Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, we talk with Amor Towles about his new short story collection called Table for Two, where we meet an agreeable Russian peasant, an indignant investment banker, and finally learn what happens to the enigmatic Eve Ross, a character in Towles' previous novel, Rules of Civility. We'll hear how small encounters in Towles' life can ignite his literary imagination, and what it's been like for him to see A Gentleman in Moscow become a television series starring Ewan McGregor. Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Amor Towles, best-selling author of The Lincoln Highway and A Gentleman in Moscow, says the title of his new book, Table for Two, arose from a subconscious conviction that our lives can often change materially due to a single conversation. It's the power of a conversation, or a chance encounter, or a sudden decision, that forced a personal reckoning for many of the characters in his latest work, a collection of six stories and a novella set in New York or Los Angeles. And listeners, what's a small encounter that had a big effect on you? Amor Towles, welcome to Forum.
Mina, thanks for having me back.
Glad to have you back. So you've said the stories in Table for Two are not about you or your family, but they were inspired by small encounters you've had. So I'd love to know what the small encounter was that gave rise to the story called The Bootlegger, about a man who records concerts at Carnegie Hall.
And I think actually the first five pages of that story are the most autobiographical thing I've ever written in my career, having written fiction since I was a kid. What happened is my wife and I were in our 30s and the kids were sleeping through the night, we decided, oh, this is a good time to get a babysitter and start going on dates again, you know. And I saw that the Russian piano player, Eugenie Kissin, who at the time was viewed as the greatest piano player in the world, was coming to America for the very first time to play at Carnegie Hall. And I was like, oh, we should go to that. You know, my wife's like, okay. So I get tickets to go through some hassle to get some tickets, and we do go to the show. And as Kissin's walking out on stage, a man arrives, takes the seat next to me in Carnegie Hall in a trench coat. And after the concert is just about to begin, I realize sticking out of his sleeve are two little black stems of a recording device. And he's recording the concert. And I could not get over it. You know, the gall of it. But then as Kissin began to play, I just went through one sort of fantasy of indignation after another, where I began to imagine, okay, you know, at the break, I'm going to alert security. And, you know, we're going to come, you know, we're going to, in the name of music, we're going to arrest this scofflaw. And I, you know, of course I didn't do that. But what I remember very vividly about this was the next day, the New York Times reported that the standing ovation that Kissin received was among the longest in recent memory at Carnegie Hall. And I don't remember Kissin playing at all. Like, you know,
oh, wow.
I had gone through all this trouble to go hear this, you know, giant who had come to America to play the piano. And I spent the entire concert thinking about the guy next to me and, you know, and in my sort of fantasy of indignation. So years go by, you know, that was in my 30s. And with all the fiction in that collection, were written in Table for Two, was written in the last 10 years. So at some point in the last 10 years, I was in between novels. I was, you know, going to write a story. And I thought, oh, yeah, I remember that night. You know, that's maybe that's an interesting starting point. So as I say, the first five pages of that story are very autobiographical. But they then imagine what would happen if this character does go out and notify security and all of sort of the unanticipated consequences of that action. And the narrator, so not the narrator, but the young man who does this, he definitely gets his just desserts.
I love that you were going to try to report the dude at Carnegie Hall in the name of music.
Yeah, totally, right?
That's a great description.
I'm an artist.
Right, exactly. But yes, you're right. Your character, Tommy, does report him, does live out, I guess, your fantasy, and then does have a very big realization. Actually, I wanted to ask you about a realization that Tommy has, where you write, so the man who was recording was named Mr. Fine. So hearing Mr. Fine's story, Tommy was deeply moved, but he also felt a pang of shame, for despite all the fuss he'd made over concert hall decorum and the rights of creative artists everywhere, he knew when all was said and done, he was an imposter. He sat in the fifth row because that's what he thought he should be doing. So first, what is appealing to you about the character of the imposter? Because I noticed you also write about another imposter of sorts in another story in your collection called The Ballad of Timothy Touchett. So yeah, what does an imposter bring to the narrative for you?
Well, I think the concept of an imposter to me is endlessly fascinating. And of course, part of that is that we are all playing the imposter at all the time, you know, and we now talk openly about sort of the concept of being an imposter in our careers. You know, when are we going to get caught? Because we're acting smarter or more sophisticated or better trained than in fact we are, you know, and we all suffer from that feeling at different times. And in fact, we feel that most strongly in the areas where we have the most competence, you know, because we've advanced through whatever our career is through our competence, and yet we still think someone's going to one day reveal that we aren't as good as we thought we were. So I think there is impostering, and there's impostering in romance, or posturing in romance, and you know, we play the imposter to some degree as we date, we do it in our family. So I just think that sort of which is just another way of saying that we wear many masks as human beings, and we are constantly navigating experiences and relationships by trying to figure out who should I be presenting myself as at this moment, consciously or unconsciously. And that's a very sort of natural part of human behavior. So then you can kind of ramp it up a little bit, right? And where you leave sort of the realm of sort of the average quality of the degree to which we all sort of change slightly here and there to accommodate a situation, and then look at someone who's really doing it purposefully, you know, and or who realizes suddenly that they've been doing it purposefully in a way that they hadn't really been self-conscious of. And so that becomes, you know, more interesting to me, kind of just as a fun thing to depict in narrative.
Yeah. So imposter syndrome afflicts novelists as well, or has
sure,
afflicted
oh, for
you
sure.
as well.
Yeah, I'm going to get discovered any minute now.
For doing what, Amor? But I guess, so how do you deal with that? I was curious so I had read related to The Bootlegger that you had actually run a couple drafts by the British cellist Stephen Isserlis, because he actually does make a cameo in the short story as well. And selfishly, I really wanted to talk with you about this story because I love the Bach cello suites too.
Yes.
And they are also part of the story.
Yep.
And so is that part of it? Like, do you deal in part with how you have to enter all these worlds and sort of be an inhabitant without truly having inhabited them by like running your stories by people who would be experts?
Well, I am more of an author who will try to imagine it fully. I don't tend to send my work out to have it double checked by experts. I'm prepared to make my mistakes and have my readers send me emails complaining about them. But what happened in that case, which made it a little bit unusual, is that I'm a planner. So whether in my novels or my short stories, I come up with the ideas long before I'm writing them. I dwell on them, and I think about them from different angles. I imagine the events, the people, the settings in great detail before I sort of outline it and then begin the work. And that's, as I say, true in the short stories as well as the novels. Just in the short stories, it's an abbreviated version of that process. And when I design this story, as it were, you have a placeholder for, well, when they get to this particular concert, there's going to be a piece of music, which is quite beautiful, and played by a soloist or in a, you know, who's accompanied by, you know, maybe one other musician. But I didn't really know who the musician would be or what the composition would be. And then you get to the point where you're actually writing the story. And I have to confront that or sort of address that. And as I'm sitting there thinking about that, suddenly I was like, oh, I know exactly who it should be and what should be played. And this is because, you know, social media, as we know, is fraught and it wastes our time. It drives us crazy. You know, it's an addictive process. It gives few real gifts, but occasionally it does give a gift. And in one for me was that through Twitter, I met one of the great living cellists in the world, Stephen Isserlis, who had become a fan of my book, A Gentleman in Moscow. And we began to correspond and then become friends, meeting, you know, dining in England and America, depending on when one of us is in each other's town. So, I know his music quite well and I know him well. So I was like, of course, I'll put Isserlis in the story, but I'll reach out to him and just double check. And so I wrote him into the story. He was thrilled. But then I was about to sort of wrap up the story. This gets to your point. I was like, ooh, you know, I can't put Isserlis in the story, playing this incredible composition of Bach, while playing this cello, which he actually, you know, played at the time, which is, you know, more than 100-year-old cello. And I can't do that without letting him just double check it, you know, and partly just to say, make sure that I don't want him to be insulted about anything that I say or misstate something or misrepresent him. So I did send it to him. And he came right back to say, hey, listen, this is great, but you should know that. And, you know, he pointed out, you know, two or three things that I had gotten wrong. And my favorite correction that came out of this is that in the story, Isserlis is sort of wrapping up the first half of the concert. He realizes there's a little bit more time left and so says, listen, because there's more time, I'm going to play this piece of Bach that isn't in the program, that becomes sort of a culminating event in the tale. And when I wrote it, I said, he looks at his watch. And, you know, and says, oh, we've got some extra time. And so Stephen comes back. He says, Amor, there is no way that I or anyone, you know, in my position would be wearing a watch. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Is that sort of because of like stage fashion? You know, is that what you're saying? You know, because, you know, or it's an abstraction or because, you know, whatever, it's part of your style. He's like, no, you don't wear a watch because you can't run the risk of scratching the cello. Right.
Right, so, as you're running your fingers along the fingerboard.
Exactly. You're moving your hands back and forth over this, you know, this instrument, which is worth whatever, hundreds of thousands of dollars, $1 million. And so anyway, so yeah, it ended up being very valuable to share that with him and to get his, you know, his feedback on some of those technical details.
Yeah, that is a detail that only a cellist would know.
Exactly.
We're talking with author Amor Towles about his new short story collection, Table for Two, and you are invited to join the conversation. What would you like to ask Amor about his latest collection or about his previous novels? If you've read any of his books, of course, he's the author of The Lincoln Highway, Rules of Civility, A Gentleman in Moscow. Maybe there's a small encounter or a quick decision that had a big or lasting effect on you or that you think could be turned into a great story. Caroline writes, I was in the post office buying stamps after waiting in a long line, and the woman working asked if I cared which stamp design I got. I said no, and she said, let me give you the most beautiful ones we have, and she handed me Farm Animals in New Snow. I've revisited that moment so many times. I love that she gave a moment of beauty to someone else completely unsolicited. We'll hear more from Amor and from you after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking this hour with Amor Towles and inviting you, our listeners, to join the conversation at 866-733-6786. Again, that number is 866-733-6786. You can email us, forum@kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels at KQED Forum. We're on X, Instagram. Our digital community is on Discord. What would you like to ask Amor Towles? Maybe you have read some of his previous works. His latest collection is called Table for Two. Maybe you've read that as well. Is there a small encounter, which is kind of a big part of Table for Two, a quick decision or a conversation that had a big or lasting effect on you, as it did for many of the characters in his new collection, or just maybe an encounter that you think could turn into a great story? Have you watched the new TV series, A Gentleman in Moscow? What did you think of that? How do you think it compared to the novel? I actually want to ask you about that, Amor. It's an 8-part series starring Ewan McGregor, streaming on a number of platforms. And I was curious, a TV series that you weren't interested in a film adaptation.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. When the book had come out and there was interest from Hollywood, I decided very early on that I would not accept offers that were based on building it into a feature film. And we did receive those and turn them away, mostly because this is the story, you know, those of you who've read A Gentleman in Moscow know, it begins in 1922, it goes all the way to 1954. So it's more than 30 years in which the character evolves a great deal, relationships evolve, the country evolves. And to try to capture that all into a feature film, I thought was unlikely. And what they'd have to do, end up doing, is taking a wedge out of the story and focusing on that to sort of fit into the constraints of a feature film. Whereas it is now an 8-hour series starring Ewan McGregor, and that really allows the series to match the structure of the novel in that it moves across those decades very fluidly.
Yeah. How did McGregor come to play the Count, and what did you think about that?
Oh, I love him. You know, he, as in all these things, something is put in his hands or through his agent, you know, a script or whatever. But he came right quickly back and said, I'm dying to do this, and I think I know this person. I can be this person, and that was particularly then after reading the novel, and because he's right. He personifies Alexander Rostov, the Count in the story, so precisely, and with such a beautiful range of acting, because that character can be proud, can be aristocratic, of course, but also goes through a great range of emotion, can be comic, can be quite philosophical, can be endearing, and he has the chance over the course of this 30-year story to really play all those various emotional notes, and he does it perfectly.
Did you have a role in writing the screenplay?
I did not. And my role was sort of at the front end, principally. The team producing the production said to me that I would be involved in, or could be involved in, hiring the head writer, hiring the director, casting the lead roles. I would have a chance to speak with the head writer and the director before they were hired to make sure that we kind of saw eye to eye. And then the idea was that, having been involved in the hiring of those key roles, that they really asked me to take a step back and let the various people do what they've been trained to do. And that makes the most sense, because that allowed me to go and write The Lincoln Highway, which is what I was doing while they were writing A Gentleman in Moscow. But before everything got started, they very nicely came and interviewed me. So, I mean, through Zoom. But the head writer interviewed me before he began writing. The director interviewed me before he began directing. And Ewan interviewed me before beginning to perform the role. In each case, just to sort of dig deeper into the narrative, what wasn't in the book that might be helpful to them, what was happening in the hotel that might help them, in Russian life that might help them, thematically, what did I think were the key elements that would be worth building into the tale. So they really did make an effort to try to understand the book. And mostly, this would be true also of the head of set design, the head of costume. Everybody was very vested in making sure that the series met the expectations of most of the readers. You're never going to please all the readers. And God bless the readers who write me and say, they changed this, I'm furious. You know, I love that, right? Because, right, they should be defending the honor of the book. But most, I think most will say, okay, this is an adaptation, but it is one which has been very true to both the structure of the story, to the spirit of the story, to the mood and aesthetics, and hitting the range of both comic and tragic elements. And I think it really does fulfill that.
Yeah. Well, on point, CC writes, I am really enjoying the series take on your book, Gentlemen in Moscow. However, a friend in my book club is very disappointed over a lot of the changes. I'm wondering how you feel about your work being changed and if you had any input in the changes.
I don't have a lot of input in the changes. So you really are, I am letting them make those decisions. Of course, every change they make is bittersweet for me. You know, I'm like, why would they do that? And why, you know, but some of it is sensible. I mean, some of it they have to change in order to serve the medium, because it is a different medium. The advantage of the book is you can hear the interior life of the Count in every scene without a word being spoken, because it's the nature of written narrative. And the television series does not have that as an advantage. They have to figure out how do we bring all that out to the surface. And sometimes they do that by creating situations that are not in the book. And so that is a part of it. I mean, part of it is there's sort of its own, the visual medium has its own sort of patterns of a way of approaching drama. You know, so one of the things that Ben did in preparing, in creating the adaptation is in a way turning up the dial on a number of different situations or the conflicts between various characters. And I prefer the more sort of subtler or more nuanced or more modulated tone of the book and of that experience. But I can understand why in the visual medium, their fear is that someone's going to start watching and quit. So they're constantly kind of turning up the temperature a little bit to try to keep the viewers there in the room.
I understand there was one scene in particular that you weren't so sure about, but then you turned to your wife and it changed your mind.
Well, that's true. Yeah. So, I mean, what happened is, when you watch a scene and it's word for word from the book, my response as I'm watching is basically, oh, that's very good. You know, they really nailed that scene. And then they're watching a scene that was between the Count and his childhood friend Mishka, and it wasn't in the book. And I start to fidget, and then I'm about to turn to my wife. It's an emotional scene. I'm about to turn to my wife to express my moderate indignation, and she is crying, you know. And I was like, honey, that's not even in the book. And she's like, I know, but it's so beautiful. You know, so sometimes, yes, they put in something which is different, but that satisfies the audience in ways that I can't anticipate. But so you do have to kind of go into it saying, okay, this is going to be a pretty true interpretation of the novel, but that there will be components that have changed.
Thank you. Well, let me go to a call from Kelly in Oakland. Kelly, you're on.
It's just a pleasure to be able to speak with you directly and express my deep appreciation for your writing. I am such a fan. I have your new book on my bedside right now. I reread Rules of Civility and Gentlemen in Moscow during COVID just to reintroduce myself to the beautiful characters. And I was just curious about how wonderful you are at recreating a female voice in Rules of Civility. And I wasn't smart enough to figure out in the beginning the end, which was quite a surprise with Tinker. But could you just express and share your, you know, thoughts about writing from a female voice? And one addendum, my husband's in a book club, and I recommended Gentlemen in Moscow, so they're reading that now, and I hope they're going to enjoy it as much as I did.
Thank you. Thank you, Kelly. Thanks for the comments and for the question. In answer to your question, I began writing fiction as 12 years old, 13 years old. So I've been writing fiction for close to 50 years, and I really began, I think, like many novelists, writing in the short story as a form. And the short story is a terrific form for young writers because it's short, it's less of a commitment of time. And as you go from story to story to story, what you can do as a writer is keep shifting all the various aspects that make up a story, all the elements of craft. You shift who the kind of who the main character is, what type of person that is. You shift the time, it's where it's setting, where it's set, what the tone of it is, how the setting is described, how the characterization occurs, what dialogue is like, how imagery is used or not used in the story, what the poetics of it are. So in each story, you can revisit these different elements of craft, and over time, what you're doing, hopefully, is mastering elements of craft by taking various different approaches. Now, out of that list, the invention of characters and is probably the most important for a novelist, because the bringing a character to full three-dimensional realization is what makes novels come alive, or fiction generally. And so you really want to work on that element, and the best way to do that is by writing stories from all different perspectives, male or female, rich or poor, whatever the religion, whatever the race, whatever the time period, just constantly writing stories from a different perspective. And hopefully over time what you're doing is mastering the ability to imagine yourself in the position of a different person, which is not simply to see what they're seeing and to respond emotionally to what they're going through, but in a way to sound like them. And because the narrative has to capture, or ideally captures, in essence, the tone of the inner life of that character that you're inventing. And when you can achieve that, as others have talked about, that character really can come to life in a way that he or she can start to make decisions for me, the writer, because they have a personality I don't have. They have been in, had experiences that I don't have, I haven't had. They're in situations I've never been in. And that combination can kind of create out of nothing this sort of relevant moment, ideally that's put beautifully, that is not a part of my personal experience. So to write from the perspective of a woman is just one on that list, you know, and over the course of my life, I've written, as I say, from all different kinds of perspectives. And you try to hear that individual who you are not and be true to their experience, their sentiments, their personality as best you can.
When you were talking about the power or role of a short story, is that why you return to it or have returned to it in between your novels, or is it something else?
Well, I mean, partly I return to it in between the novels because when a novel comes out, or even as it, once you've handed it in the final manuscript, there's sort of a period of time which isn't quite long enough to immerse myself into the work of a novel, where I really do want to be fully immersed with a very long runway of free time ahead of me. Because I know that I might have to be doing some interviews. I'm going to be on the road some, you know. So I'm going to be doing the final round of editing. I'm going to have marketing meetings or whatever, you know. So during that kind of time frame, I will often turn back to the short story because it's something that I can tackle in a shorter window of time. And so all these kind of, these stories were kind of written in the interstices between the novels. But more to the bigger point, I do like going back to the short story, not simply because it's convenient time-wise, but because it is a very different art form. And probably the biggest distinction for me between them is that the novel, I think consciously or unconsciously, the novelist puts a lot of work into the first 50 pages to orient the reader. So in that first 50 pages or even less, the novelist consciously or unconsciously wants to help the reader know where this is taking place and all the things that that means, when it's taking place and what that means, who the central characters are and what their connection is to each other, what they're like and what their immediate background has been. There might be indication of some things that happened in the recent or deep past. They may have bearing on the story. There may be foreshadowings of where this narrative is going. There may be motifs introduced that are going to repeat over the course of the tale. And all this orientation is very valuable and important to the experience of reading a novel, because the reader needs to know all that to begin the adventure with confidence, as it were, so they can begin to see how the characters are evolving, how the themes are shifting, how events are stacking upon each other and with all kinds of implications. But they need to start from a point of confidence, a reasonable confidence, in order to go through that experience well. Well, a short story has none of that, right? A short story is too short, by definition, to include this sort of orientation phase. And that's very liberating, I think, both for the writer and for the reader. For the writer, I don't have to build all that stuff. I have to know it. It's a part of my knowledge base, but I'm going right in to, as the events are unfolding, and you're coming with me. And so you sort of have that experience of, okay, where are we? You know, who's talking? Why is she mad at him? You know, what happened yesterday? And wait, is this in the Midwest or in the Northeast? You know, you're piecing it together, even as you can sense this story's going to be over in any minute now. You know, so I'm not going to have this, see this event as a part of a chain of events which lead to some sort of culminating chapter. This is it. And so I, as the reader, have to be studying this sort of moment and living this moment openly and with sort of the mindset that when I hit that last page, I'm going to decide where does this all go in the lives of these characters. The author's not going to tell me that. That's for me to determine. And so, as I say, I think this is sort of beautiful liberty in the short story for the writer and the reader around the fact that it is a glimpse into the lives of some people, and that a lot of the authority still remains with the reader.
Yeah. Well, the very first story in your collection, which is called The Line, is also set mainly in Moscow and at a historical period as the Bolsheviks are coming to power. And while Gentleman in Moscow is about an aristocrat, this story is about a peasant farmer named Pushkin. And I guess you do need to know it. You do need to know that history to be able to do this very short story. And I wonder how you think about the role of history in The Line or in your work generally, like how you visualize its role in the story.
For me, history is, I don't think of myself as an historical novelist, or I don't think of myself as writing historical novels. I'm just a novelist. And history for me is, I've often talked about it when I came out and spoke to in San Francisco just a few weeks ago. For me, it's like the painted backdrop in a play. You know, at the very back of the set, behind the actors, behind the furniture, behind the architecture that's been built by the stage crew, there may be a painted canvas that's been dropped, which tells you kind of in the distance what's happening, you know, or whether you're looking through the windows, say, into Chekhov's cherry orchard off in the distance. And for me, that's the role that history plays, is that it's this sort of canvas that's been painted impressionistically rather than precisely and dropped behind events to give the reader a sense of time, a sense of place, a sense of mood. But it's not the focus, right? It's not why we're here. It's not what I'm trying to do or what you should be focused on either as the reader. It's the backdrop that provides us some context in which to study what's really happening, which is the interaction between the individuals and to some degree the poetry of the language itself.
Yeah. There was, in reading The Line, it seemed like a meditation on capitalism and communism and how a capitalist idea can take root in a communist system and a socialist idea can take root in a capitalist system. But it also felt like it was meditating on sort of our shared instinct to develop relationships with others or also provide for ourselves independently, regardless of the economic system we're subjected to.
Yes. Well, and it's you're absolutely right. And the origin of that story is... and that story is kind of a sleight of hand because the six short stories before the novella in this collection, which is half of the book, they're all, five of the six are set in New York entirely. And this first story begins in Russia, but ends up in New York. And as I say, that's the sleight of hand because you enter the collection and you're like, wait, where are we going with this? And, but, you know, I'm taking you to New York pretty quickly and that's where you're going to be. But the origin of that story really comes from writing A Gentleman in Moscow. And there's a moment in Gentleman in Moscow where the Count's friend Mishka returns from having done time in the prison camps.
And I might have to ask you to hold that thought, Amor, because we're just about to come up on a break. So stay with us, listeners. We'll have more. This is Forum.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. We're talking this hour with Amor Towles about his new story collection called Table for Two. His other books, of course, include The Lincoln Highway, Rules of Civility, A Gentleman in Moscow, and that's been recently adapted as an 8-part television series. Join the conversation at 866-733-6786, at our social channels, at KQED Forum, at our email address, forum@kqed.org. And just before the break, Amor, you were talking about your inspiration for the first story in Table for Two, The Line.
Yes. And all I was going to say was that in A Gentleman in Moscow, the character Mishka returns from the prison camps in the 30s, and he's in sort of a cynical state of mind, is observing, oh, the success of Bolshevism, we can see it in that we've become, you know, the greatest inventor of lines in the world. You know, we have lines for everything. And I remember sort of, as I was sort of writing that, sort of thinking about all the various lines that were in Moscow at the time for all the different things that you would have had to wait for. And thinking, wow, would it be interesting if there was a guy who he wasn't really good at almost anything, but he was really good at standing in line, you know, whatever that means. And that kind of, I kind of set that aside. And when I finished A Gentleman in Moscow, I then wrote this story, which begins with that. And as I was beginning to imagine that story, one of the things that occurred to me, and this goes back to your question, Mina, is that, interestingly, you know, there were a lot of lines in Russia in the 1930s for you know, a whole array of reasons that were due to them restructuring the economy and trying to achieve this new Soviet ideal, which never really fully came to success. But it occurred to me that meanwhile, suddenly in the United States there were lines, but for very different reasons. You know, because we had suddenly the Depression in the United States, and the 30s had lines. We had lines for bread and for, you know, all kinds of things. When suddenly the American population was under economic duress. And I thought, oh, that's sort of interesting that these two sort of opposing countries were having lines at the same time. And what if my line stander, my great line stander Pushkin, what if he ended up in both lines, you know, the Russian lines and the American line? And there's something about the line that sort of just as a sort of a pause here, that there's something sort of beautiful about it as the humane, sort of from a humane standpoint, in that when societies have to deal with lines, you are in a moment in time where kind of many of the population are sort of leveled to some sort of, you know, challenge. There's a challenge in the society. And suddenly you go to get your whatever it is you're trying to get, your food, your paycheck, your, you know, whatever. And you have a person in front of you and a person behind you, right? And that's, you didn't come together. You come from different parts of the city. You have a different background, and you are going to be standing there for an hour, for 2 hours, waiting, you know, to do this essential thing in this distressed time, as it were. And there's, I think there's an opening there for either cynicism and anger, or for the opposite, right? For the possibility of human connection, basically making the most of this frustrating process of having to stand in line. And so the story kind of explores that as well.
Yeah, no, it really does. Well, the sister writes, I leaned on A Gentleman in Moscow during the pandemic, and since, I have one copy upstairs and one down, always ready on hand. The characters are so completely real that I still spend time thinking about their lives after the end of the book. Also, it encouraged me to study Russian, although I am only really good at saying two vodkas, please. Wow, talk about an encounter that had a big effect on someone's life. Love that. Let me go to Lori in Redwood City. You're on, Lori.
Thank you very much. And I just have to say how much I did enjoy Gentleman in Moscow. It was an exquisitely written book and an exquisite book. And I'm looking forward to this one. But I did want to share, if talking about encounters with people, probably in the late 70s, I was a student at the Aspen Music Festival in Colorado. And it's a long festival, it's 9 weeks, and kind of a slog, but very fun. And there was a tradition back then of students hitchhiking from the school grounds down to the town, which was down a windy, twisty road, and not waiting for the bus, which would take forever. And so I started doing that because I realized the people who are going to give me rides were extremely famous musicians who were there teaching. And so I ended up getting rides with Itzhak Perlman, and which was kind of frightening. He's a bat out of hell on a road. And Jan DiCatani and Werner Klemper was there doing a voice performance. And, of course, his father was a famous conductor. And so getting picked up by Colonel Klink was kind of the icing on the cake.
Yeah.
But each one of them was actually more interested in what I was doing there, where I was from, and what I was getting out of the festival and studying there for the summer. So they were equally interested in a student, which I thought was really great.
Aww.
Yeah. That's a beautiful story. And I would make you want to just hitchhike back and forth from town to the musical campus without it. You just go back and forth all day.
Yeah.
One ride after another.
And there were many more. In nine weeks, I got a lot of rides. So it was never anyone that was dull.
Well, brilliant move, Laurie. I love it. Thanks for sharing that. Well, listener Nina writes, I'm always excited to hear Amor Towles. I first discovered his work when he was on KQED for the Lincoln Highway. I proceeded to read everything Mr. Towles had written through that point in a matter of 5 to 6 weeks. Those were long novels, one I could not put down and kept reading even when I had to cook dinner for my family. The Lincoln Highway, that's going to also be adapted, right?
Yes, that's true.
As and, a feature film or for screen?
That is a feature film, and it's going to be a feature film from Warner Brothers. And what's particularly exciting there is that it will be written and directed by Chris Storr, and Chris Storr is the person who created, writes, and directs The Bear, the terrific television series about the little restaurant in Chicago. And that's incredibly compelling television if you haven't seen it. And it's been winning lots of awards, and deservedly so. And Chris, I think, is going to do a terrific job with the Lincoln Highway.
Wow, that's exciting. I understand Rules of Civility, too, but what's the status with that?
Rules of Civility has been in development for, I don't know, 13 years now or something like that. So, I mean, who knows what's going to happen there? And, you know, I think you're lucky to have any book of yours optioned. You're even more lucky to have one actually survive the process and come out, like in the case of Gentleman in Moscow. So if the Lincoln Highway also gets made, I'd be ahead of my own expectations. But I think that the Rules of Civility will be made at some point. It's just you just never know. All the pieces have to come together, and it's there's a lot of chance involved in that field.
Yeah, well, it's the novella in your new book, Eve in Hollywood, that brings us to Los Angeles and also picks up where we left Eve in Rules of Civility when she's leaving New York and heading home to Indiana. And we learn that she's changed her ticket to go all the way to L.A. Why did you continue Eve's story?
You know, Eve in Rules of Civility was, I just loved her as a character. I mean, she is a you know, a beautiful young woman from the Midwest who'd come to New York, but she's very independent-minded. You know, she's one of these people who hates being told what to do, hates someone thinking they know what she's going to do. So she's constantly doing the opposite of what you think she's going to do, kind of to teach you a lesson. And I love that about her. And you know, and I felt that way even as the writer. She was constantly kind of in, as I was writing, shifting course and, you know, sort of in essence surprising me with her actions. Most importantly, in that novel, she decides to go home to Indiana. She's been in a terrible accident where she's disfigured a little. She has had a relationship go south. And so she says, I'm going home, you know, to the folks in Indiana. And I was writing the scene while she was on the train, about ready to get off in Chicago at Union Station, where her family was waiting, her parents were waiting. And I kind of, as the train was pulling into the station, you know, she was like, I'm not getting off the train. And it's like, oh my God, she's right. She would never get off this train. And instead she extends her ticket and goes all the way to Hollywood in 1938. And so we see that she's disappeared into Hollywood in Rules of Civility. But that's about it. And so when that novel was over, that just, it kept lingered with me. I kept wondering, you know, what is she doing out there? And eventually I began to get around to, I wrote six short pieces that kind of describe her first days in Hollywood from the perspective of five different people who meet her and who she has an effect on. And we begin to kind of get a glimpse of what she might do in Los Angeles. And I did that 10 years ago. And in the last 2 years, I realized that it wasn't enough. Like, I had not fulfilled her story. Mm-hmm. So I took that back, that 60 pages. I actually flew out. She arrives in Los Angeles in 38 and moves into the Beverly Hills Hotel. And so I took these 60 pages and I flew out to Los Angeles and moved into the Beverly Hills Hotel, because that's the kind of sacrifice I'm willing to make for my art. And I began to sort of imagine, okay, where what is going to happen to her now? I mean, really, you know, not simply the glimpse. What's really going to happen to her, to these people who she's meeting? How do they get involved with each other? And how does she really sort of come to understand her new future now that she's sort of left this New York opportunity behind her? And so that sort of went from 60 to 200 plus pages and is now half of the collection. And I think it is a lot of fun.
Well, the New York Times Review described Table for Two as a tale of two cities. And it really does feel like that's what's coming together in this novella as well, since she is leaving New York. The first half, of course, of the stories are also set in New York and the novella in Los Angeles. But what do you think of that characterization? Does it resonate?
Yeah, and in fact, you know, and I do think they're right. And if you opened up the collection, it explicitly kind of is broken into New York and Los Angeles. And because I could feel that in a way, you know, sort of the these two sort of coastal icons, you know, Los Angeles and New York, that have affected our the cultural mythology so profoundly, not only by as symbols of two very different kinds of symbols of American life and achievement, but they also have funneled all kinds of invention into American cultural life, right? Movies coming out of Los Angeles, and you know, television really starting in New York, and the musical scene in New York being so robust, the theater scene being robust, there being a literary history in both places. Not that there isn't art made all across the United States, because of course there is. But these are two big capitals of cultural invention and have become sort of, I think, a part of the cultural imagination. So it is sort of interesting to write sort of one set of stories and the other about them side by side. And the tone does shift when you move to the Los Angeles stories. Mm. I think of, you know, in American culture, jazz as being a uniquely American invention that really couldn't have been invented almost anywhere else in the world. But as soon as it was invented, it was embraced and taken up by and reinterpreted by cultures all around the globe. And noir is another version of that. Noir is a uniquely American invention that, you know, is beloved in France and Japan and has been, you know, adopted and experimented with both in film and in writing in various cultures around the world while recognizing it as an American idiom. And so as someone who loves American narrative and the history of American narrative, it was inevitable that I was going to eventually want to experiment with some aspect of the noir storytelling. So having a woman with a scar taking a train and landing in Los Angeles in 1938, you know, it was the perfect time to kind of take on that tone. So that's very different than the New York stories, which have this kind of sophisticated New York society sort of feel to them.
Right.
And you shift to Los Angeles and you get that very different kind of tone.
Yeah. We're talking with Amor Towles about his new book, Table for Two. This happens to be a fundraising period for many public radio stations, and you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Well, Martha writes, well, let me remind listeners, too, you are sharing and welcome to share small encounters that you have had, quick decisions that have had a bigger lasting effect, like maybe to change your destination on a plane. You're also welcome to share reflections on Amor Towles' work and what it's meant to you. And Martha writes, my husband's best friend, who he met in Beirut in 1969, is the gentleman from Moscow. You described a true gentleman, a Renaissance man with wit and brilliance. Our gentleman is the son of a genocide survivor whose father sent him from Turkey to Alexandria, where his English skills found him on a ship as a young translator to the British to Gallipoli. He recites Eliot, speaks five languages, delights dinner guests with his writings and broad knowledge of the world as he refurbishes fine vintage shoes for men and curates vintage color travel lithographic posters from the late 18th and early 20th century. Wow. Well, thank you for sharing.
Wow, right, exactly.
Your husband's best friend with us. Zoe writes, the first Mr. Towles book I read was A Gentleman in Moscow, and I fell in love with his work. I've read his other books and just now placed a hold on Table for Two at the library. So glad you have him as a guest today. Thank you, Mr. Tolles, for great writing, remarkable stories. And I look forward to all your future books. We've definitely talked about your future film projects with your books, but are there any next projects or books you want to tell us about anymore?
Sure. You know, and sort of what's interesting in this moment is that I was, I plan my books long in advance. I have sort of a long design phase, as I was saying earlier. So as I was finishing The Lincoln Highway, I already knew what was I was going to work on next and had been working on it sort of in the background for years. And I started that novel when I finished The Lincoln Highway. And I got about a quarter or a third into that writing of that novel. And I suddenly realized that two of the central characters in that novel had appeared in shorter work of mine. And so I stopped writing the novel because I decided I really wanted readers to have a chance to meet those two characters in the context of these shorter works before they saw them in the context of this bigger novel. And so I stopped. I began to pull together the various short work that ended up being A Table for Two. I wrote several new pieces. I expanded the Eve story, as I mentioned. And partly because I wanted all that to be out in the world so that when people turn to the next novel, they'll have they'll be able to track sort of the lives of these two characters and how they end up in this new story. The new story begins in Cairo at the end of the Second World War, and it ends in New York City in 1999. And that's all I'm really willing to tell you about it. And I'm gonna leave it for you to guess as you read Table for Two which two characters are going to show up later.
Love it. Well, this listener wants to know, who would you like to see play the roles of Emmett and Billy? Oh, this is for the Lincoln Highway.
Oh, yeah. Well,
have you thought that far? Do you know?
You know, we have not gotten that far. You know, I think there are some people who are very interested in being in the story, both because they like the book and because everybody is you know, very excited about Chris Storr's work on The Bear and are eager to, you know, work with him in what will be his kind of his first major feature film. And so I think we're going to have some terrific people in it. And as to like who, I don't have a strong opinion about that. The main characters tend to be around 18. Billy is 8, you know, so, you know, for Billy, we'll certainly see a fresh face. We may see a variety of fresh actors fulfilling those roles of the 18-year-olds. I think we may see a couple of star-level performers, you know, who are in their, you know, late 20s, but who are, you know, who play the 19-year-old as well.
We just have less than a minute, Amor, but I did want to ask you about a cameo in one of your short stories, and that is Paul Auster, who recently passed away on April 30th. He's in The Ballad of Timothy Touchett. Why Paul Auster? Is there a connection there?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have not met Paul Auster personally, but I certainly love his work and know his work. And that story there is imposter dynamics in that story. And I wanted, in the course of that story, I had sort of in the plan that a living author would see a signature of his that was fraudulent and would suddenly realize, oh, but, you know, that's not my signature. And would sort of set in motion a series of events in the tale. And I kind of had author, you know, capital A, period, in my sort of outline and my design stuff. And when I was sitting down and writing it, I was like, well, now who is it going to be? You know, who could it be? And do I just make someone up or is it someone real? And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, my God, you know, it should be Auster. And for those of you who don't know his work, I mean, you should read the New York Trilogy. It's, you know, extraordinary classic of contemporary American writing, and in it there are imposters, and so it was very natural for Auster to suddenly be the person who does that.
Listeners, read that and read Amor Tolles' Table for Two. Thank you again, Amor. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Did you ever wonder what it's like to live alone, hidden in the woods, not speaking to a single soul for 30 years? Or wander the desert, uncover a hidden well, and dive to the bottom of the deepest water hole for 2,000 miles? The Snap Judgment Podcast takes you there with amazing stories told by the people who live them, with an original soundscape that drops you directly into their shoes. Snap Judgment. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.